From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report for the first day of May 2019. I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Jackie Bakes. She's from Stuart Peterson. We'll check the weather forecast. I can tell you it's not getting any better, but Drew Lerner will be here to detail it from the Dakotas to Ohio and from the Delta region all the way through Michigan. We'll hear more about the weather, the rainfall, maybe even some conditions that some folks might be able to move in parts of the Corn Belt, maybe, but probably not from him. And we'll also check in on an event that happened earlier today in Washington, D.C., a bipartisan, bicameral gathering of congresswomen and men that are looking to push forward the extension of the blender's tax for biodiesel. And we'll do all of that right here on this Wednesday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
We're now joined by Jackie Vakes. She's from Stuart Peterson to take a look at what happened in Chicago for the day. Hey, Jackie, thanks for being with us. I know you had an interesting week last week. You weren't with us. That's because you were in Chicago. You were at the Data Users Group meeting and another meeting after that. So looking forward to talking to you today.
Yep, I'm looking forward to talking to you. I always hate missing any days, but it was worthwhile. There's no question about that.
Absolutely. Let's talk about these support and resistance levels to begin with, because, well, they've been moving and they're really important, especially for soybeans at this time.
Oh, they really are. Well, we'll start with corn. We're going to use July and September. You know, May is gone. And so, well, we're in first notice on May. Support on July 351.5, 332, and 317. Resistance 372, 384, and then 398. September, support 360, then 344, and 337. And resistance is at 380, 389, and 401. You know, that, Todd, that September contract is always kind of a gray contract because some of it is old crop, some of it is considered new crop down in the south. And so it's always a little, it usually carries a little bit of a premium reflecting some of the new crop too. On beans, July support 840, 798, 765. Resistance 890, 905, and then 971 with major resistance. August 840 is support 806 and 778. And resistance 895, 940, and 965.
You know, one of the things I was thinking about, because we are supply-driven at this point, we may be demand-driven at some point, but supply-driven, and sometimes we put the carryouts in number of days that are available. Have you done that?
I have. I actually went through, I was curious myself. Right now, we have 50 days of corn supplies in the United States, and just to give a contrast, in 2012, we had 25 days. At the world level, we have 100 days, and in 2012, we had 50 days. And so when you look at beans, and here you can see, too, why this is a tough bean picture, 80 days of supplies. 2012, we had 10 days. And at the world level, 112 days, which is the highest since 1988. And in 2012, we had 80 days. You know, so it's a it doesn't paint a picture, you know, that it isn't the whole picture, but it just doesn't paint a picture that says we're going to go through the moon. You know, I mean, it's just we have a lot of supply all over the world, basically.
Well, that's the supply side. And then you mentioned all over the world, but really it's the export bushels or the extra bushels that aren't used domestically in any country that really help to set the price of a crop. What do our export inspections look like?
Well, that's been really interesting, Todd, and that's one of the things, you know, that I follow that very closely. Wheat is 2.4% behind last year right now, with the USDA saying a 14% increase year over year. I think we could make it. They need 28 million bushels per week to meet that goal, and that's not out of the picture. We're pretty close to actually averaging that, and so that would really be something because they were way behind. Now, on corn, we're 10.6% ahead. At one point, we were 61.3% ahead. So we definitely have have slowed down our corn inspections. USDA is at 1% behind for year over year, and beans were at 27.6% behind. Now, there was a point in time when beans were well over 50% behind, so USDA expects a 3% decrease there. So it's going to be interesting to see how it all shakes out, but I do think wheat has a chance.
Speaking of wheat, have you been watching the Kansas Wheat Tour this week?
I really have, and it's pretty scary. You know, they're saying in Kansas they may have one of the best winter wheat crops that they can remember. You know, and so Kansas, Colorado, Nebraska, they're saying anywhere from 44 to 46.7 bushels per acre, and the 5-year average is 39.5. So, you know, it's I guess it's hard to believe that it's that good. But then again, you know, we've had snow and everything else that really helps the wheat crop along.
And on that note, we have had snow and rain and everything else across the Corn Belt. What do you think about planting dates and what this might do to yield?
Well, Emerson Natzinger from the University of Illinois put out a really nice piece, you know, and so he's just talking about the state of Illinois, but that's extremely important. And so to get the maximum yield, usually needs to be planted by late April, early May. Okay, and I will put a caveat to that. My comment is everything depends upon soil temperature. But planted by May 10th, yield normally would decline 5%. May 20th, 9%, and May 30th, 14%. When you look at beans, by May 1st, 2%. May 15th, 7%. May 30th, 12%, and June 10th, 18%. Now, you know, and I agree with that 100%. The big thing that we have to be careful of when we're trying to judge what's going to happen is we don't have it going for us this year like we did last year, where we actually warmed up the soil rapidly. We've been pretty cold. We've been under, you know, a lot of times below normal temperatures. And so if the soil is adequate, it really takes off. And we proved that last year with the size of the crop. So, but I think that this is really important. I'm sure that they can find this on the website at the University of Illinois.
Absolutely. We'll put that on our willag.org website, or you can look for the bulletin. That's the bulletin from the University of Illinois in Google. Let's stay with crops for just a moment. I do have one other thing with the livestock I want to take up with you. But we've been watching, of course, the price of soybeans over the last year in Brazil. I'm wondering if that's changed very much as it relates to the price of soybeans in the United States.
Well, it really is very interesting, because if you remember a year ago, the premiums down in the Brazilian ports were $2 a bushel over Chicago, or more at times, you know, because of the demand out of China. And those premiums are pretty much gone. You know, over the past 30 days, they have declined to the point where they're down to only 27 cents over Chicago in April. And for the July premium is only 40 cents over Chicago. So what's happening down in Brazil is basically they're sitting on a crop. They're waiting, you know, to see if it's going to improve at all. They're waiting, you know, to see if the U.S. dollar is going to get stronger, all of those things. But they're just sitting on their hands waiting at the moment. And then they got another pretty good kick in the pants when the National Land Transportation Agency increased the freight rates by 4% this week because of the diesel prices. Now, they've got the authority to adjust freight rates every 6 months if the price of diesel fuel either increases or decreases by 10%. So, you know, it's a tough one. So the down and dirty, Todd, is that the Brazilian farmer will ultimately end up paying the higher freight rates, just like we do. It's either going to be a weaker basis, or we're going to see the futures go down, one or the other. But they haven't got the sweetest situation. One other thing I wanted to mention, Todd, and I think this is important, is we talk about managed money, because we hear a lot of people saying, oh, you know, they're so short, it's just going to go through the moon. You know, it's going to come right back. When you look at managed money right now in soft red winter, they're 79,000 short. Corn, they're 310,000 short. The highest that they were ever short is 322,215, and that was just set on the 23rd of April of this year. And on beans, they're short 152,000, and the highest they'd ever been before that was 129,566, and that was set on April 23rd. So now they've gotten even shorter than that. So, and they're short also 31,000 soy meal and short 65,000 soy oil. So there's no question that there could be a bounce coming out of this because of how short the, you know, the position is that they have. But at the same time, we have to really be on top of it because I don't think it would be a long-term bounce. I think what it'll be more like it'll be a bounce and then it'll be a sell, and then it'll be a bounce and then it'll be a sell. And so I just wanted to make sure people were aware of that.
And finally, something you mentioned to me about the CME group and that it's reintroducing some livestock contracts. And also, did you see that they're going to sell or trying to sell the CBOT, the Board of Trade building, for some $330 million?
Yes. Well, they're not dumb. I can tell you that much. The CME actually, they owned their own building, basically, is what it was. And so they're pretty smart. Yeah, and I would imagine, you know, that if the opportunity is there, why not take it? But yes, they are going to be at that meeting. We talked, CME came in and talked a little bit, and they're going to reintroduce the pork belly contract, which is quite something. And supposedly it's going to actually reflect the contract much better than the old pork belly contract did. But it's due to the demand for bacon. The demand for bacon has just gone through the roof. And so it'll be coming shortly. They didn't say the exact date that they were going to let it go, but it'll be here, you know. And so right on time for, record pork production that we've got, which I think we probably need for China demand. And, one of the other things we talked about is it could take 5 to 6 years for China to return to full capacity on pork if they can get it under control and they're willing to reinvest. That's a big if.
Oh, it's good stuff. Hey, thank you so much.
Thanks, Todd. Have a great day.
You too. That is Jackie Vike. She is with Stuart Peterson. In today's agricultural news, members of Congress rallied for the biodiesel tax credit today. Republicans and Democrats stood near the U.S. Capitol in support of a 2-year extension of the $1 per gallon blender's credit. Iowa Senator Joni Ernst says the biodiesel industry directly supported more than 3,800 jobs in her state and that soybean farmers suffering an economic downturn need the stability the bill would provide.
Iowa's ag economy is already facing hard economic conditions, and the lapse of the biodiesel tax incentive has left even more Iowa jobs hanging on the line. We need to provide certainty for our producers, and extending this tax credit would help us do just that.
Congresswoman Sherry Bustos of Illinois' 17th District praised the bipartisan and bicameral way in which the biodiesel bill is moving on the Hill. The House and Senate versions of the legislation are the same, and she is hopeful it will be passed quickly.
In my congressional district, in the city of Lena, the town of Lena, the town of Anawan, we have two biodiesel plants. They are critical at a time when our family farmers are hurting. They need to make sure that we do something like this. And again, we stand here together, but we've got to make sure that we act on the biodiesel tax credit, that we don't delay this, and that we have a sense of urgency that our farmers want to see us have. We are ready for this. Thank you very much.
Driving the bill, in part through the House of Representatives, will be Congressman Darren LaHood. He represents Illinois' 18th District and serves on the Ways and Means Committee.
The bill will start in our committee, and look forward to being a strong proponent, working with my colleagues on that committee to make sure we get this passed. The district that I represent is the 8th largest in the country in terms of corn and soybean production. And it's vitally important to my district and to the country.
LaHood says the biodiesel industry supports 60,000 jobs nationwide. The 2-year legislative extension is also retroactive. It would include a credit for gallons blended so far in 2019 and those from 2018. Well, let's stay with biofuels for the moment, but we'll switch to ethanol, where supporters are hailing the Environmental Protection Agency's near-proposed final rule for year-round sales of E15 gasoline, but admit a key part of the rule could severely limit intended summertime sales. EPA's proposed E15 rule gives the ethanol industry just about everything it wanted, with one glaring exception: the ability of most filling stations to make E15 on-site, unless the E85 they mix with E10 lacks conventional gas impurities. The alternative, buy more expensive blend stock from a terminal. Iowa U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley, who led the charge for year-round E15 sales, says the restriction is a non-starter.
That is something that we have to work out before this rule goes into effect, because if we don't work it out, it's going to cut about 50% of the potential use of ethanol out.
Grassley says that's got to come out of the final rule.
And just think how ridiculous it is. Now, I want to say very, very ridiculous for at a filling station to say that a filling station that has a blender pump is a blender. Now, that's just stupid.
The Renewable Fuels Association blames EPA staffers concerned about gasoline impurities in E85, but says the ban plays into the hands of oil refiners who favor impediments to blending ethanol. RFA's Jeff Cooper says the on-site blending restriction would eliminate half the 5 to 7 cent E15 discount over E10, while some stations say they just won't sell E15 in the summer, but will sell flex fuels instead. Well, let's stay in Washington, but we'll switch topics. The Trump administration this week signaled a willingness to provide more trade aid to farmers if needed. However, Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue says the claims are untrue, while in Iowa, Perdue stated, "I'm afraid that's not accurate." White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow told reporters Monday that the Trump administration had allocated $12 billion for farmers last year and that they stand ready to do more if necessary. Perdue has repeatedly ruled out any new trade aid for 2019. The Department of Agriculture this week extended the deadline, by the way, to certify acres under the Market Facilitations Program to May 17th. The program has already paid producers more than $8 billion for losses that occurred in 2018. As a result of the retaliatory tariffs from China. Perdue says the president has not discussed any further trade aid for farmers with him. Talks with China could conclude within the next 2 weeks, and a possible agreement may be signed in June. We'll stay with trade for the moment. Following a visit to the United States, Japan's prime minister met with Justin Trudeau of Canada to strengthen trade ties there. In a news release from Canada, officials say the two leaders reaffirmed their commitment to strengthen the strategic partnership between Canada and Japan. The two leaders also discussed the comprehensive and progressive agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership, which Canada says is already creating good middle-class jobs and new opportunities for businesses in that nation and Japan. Canada and Japan are partners in the CPTPP, a free trade agreement between Canada and 10 other countries in the Asian Pacific region. And that's a look at the day's agricultural news. This is the closing market report for Wednesday afternoon. Drew Lerner is here from World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. Drew, there's been so much rainfall across the Corn Belt that now it's mostly about how many gap days there are between the rains and whether there's enough time to dry soils out, to run equipment over the top of it. Have you been thinking about this much?
I have, and I've been scratching my head quite a bit trying to figure out just exactly how much window we're going to get, and I don't see much window in any part of the Midwest Corn Belt over this next week to maybe 8 or 9 days. Now, when I say that, there's going to be a few areas that don't get rain every day, and I don't want to imply that there won't be some field work done. But the problem here is that I don't think we're stringing more than a couple of days of dry weather at a time, and that's just not enough for the areas that are just too wet to begin with. So we'll end up with just sitting on our hind ends here for a while, waiting for a bigger gap of dry weather to occur. Now, we are seeing down in the second week of the outlook some attempted ridge building in the middle of the country. Now, typically, at this time of the year, in mid-May, we usually find a ridge of high pressure that starts to build in the middle of the country. It's a seasonal event. It's normal. We always see it. The models are trying to generate it, but I think they're having trouble doing so because there's so much energy in this jet stream we have right now. And that ridge of high pressure is probably going to have a real hard time holding in place or being strong enough to completely shut down the rain machine. So what I think will happen here as we get into the second half of this month, we are going to have bigger gaps in the rain, but we'll also have bigger rain events when we get the rains to return. So it's going to be a kind of a tough thing. But we will have more dry days and an opportunity for field work very aggressively between rain events as we get into the second half of this month.
No, that's not exactly what producers wanted to hear. I want to take you through some specific areas. In the crop progress report, I think Iowa said maybe a third, I can't quite recall this, of the crops had been planted in the southern tier of Iowa. Let's just call that the southern, below Des Moines. Are they going to still be able to move in Missouri and that part of Iowa this week?
I do think that there will be some progress in those areas. They do have a little less of rain and a little less frequency in this next 4 or 5 days in that area. It's not going to be completely dry, but I think there will be a little bit of opportunity. It is certainly not going to be aggressive, though.
Yeah, and so then through the Dakotas, the center part of Iowa, Minnesota, Wisconsin, the largest part of Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, not much hope?
Yeah, well, in the upper parts of the Midwest and the Northern Plains, the problem isn't just rain, it's cold, and that's where the biggest problem is. They aren't getting that much moisture up that far north right now, but it's not warming up enough. Temperatures are only going to be in the 40s and 50s across a part of the north central United States over the next several days. Normal highs should at least be in the 60s. And we're just not going to get there. So the evaporation rates will be too low for them to really be seeing a good drying event there. In the eastern Midwest, the heart of the Midwest, from Illinois into Ohio, I think probably the farther east you travel, the better the potential will be that drier weather will come in the second half of the month. But for this next week to week and a half, we definitely have too much rain moving through those areas. And if we get a field planted or two out there, it's not going to be a whole lot more than that because we just don't have enough dry days between the rain events.
You mentioned that cold in the upper Midwest. How worried are you?
Well, I am really quite concerned about the situation there, because while we wait for warmer weather to come into that region, they will have the least amount of rainfall coming through the region and may actually have below average precipitation for a while. But without warmer temperatures, they're not going to firm up nicely. And so what's going to happen when the warmth does come in, it's going to push this jet stream, this very active jet stream, back to the north again. And that's going to put parts of the upper Midwest and northern plains right in line with all this active weather. And so I'm afraid that that area is not going to get a good opportunity to dry down before the really big rains start to come.
Hey, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
All right. Have a good day.
You too. That's Drew Lerner. He is with World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City.